The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning. So last week, the question at the end of the session was about not self. And I said that I would take this session to try to answer or address that question in some fashion. And it occurred to me to just see, to begin by checking in with you and getting a sense of what your questions are about this teaching of anatta or not self. What is it? Just simply, I guess I want to hear what kind of understanding you have and what questions you might have, just to see if I can kind of direct my talk about towards the kinds of questions you might have. And if you don't have questions, I'll just talk. But but I'd like to give a chance to see what there might be in the room around this topic.
I guess the question I have surrounding the topic is how to cultivate the ability to recognize, see one, that characteristic along with the other two in all things.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That's a large part of what I had planned to talk about.
It's a pretty naive question, but what are the benefits? What's for somebody maybe not too spiritual, or maybe you are by the time you have that state, but, you know, just kind of some sense of...
What are the benefits of seeing that?
Yeah, why would you want to, you know, be... That's a naive question.
Take a few notes. So what are the benefits of seeing not self, and what does it do for not you? Okay.
I have a question.
Sophia.
What can we maybe I just answered my own question, I'm not sure, but I was thinking, like, you know, how we can maintain the awareness of anatta. I think I answered the question, but maybe by focusing on, constantly focusing on mindfulness and focusing on the bare attention. But the thing is, you know, how to keep that, I guess, I don't know, it's just through meditation, I guess, to increase the concentration, to maintain this awareness.
Okay, thank you.
So I have if it fits in the scheme of how are you going to address this, could you talk about the ego?
Ego.
In relation to the self.
What do you mean by ego?
I mean the manager, the one that organizes.
The one who thinks they're in control?
Yeah.
Okay. that
I guess you just answered it.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, I'll try to touch on these as I go over. So first of all, just a kind of a context around this term, anatta, not self. It is often talked about as being one of three universal characteristics of everything that we experience. That in our coming into our contact with our moment-to-moment experience of body and mind, we start to see that all of our experience is changing. Which is the characteristic of anicca, impermanence. We begin to recognize that because, and actually, you know, the characteristic of anicca in some ways is the easiest to, it's the easiest to understand in many ways, because it is what we do recognize this as being true of our experience. Even though we don't take in the actual sense of impermanence, we know in our intellect we know things are impermanent. As we begin to touch into the actuality of impermanence, to really contact the fact that, oh, actually, this means everything is impermanent, and moment to moment, everything is impermanent. And it can be kind of startling to us when we actually contact that reality. When we actually meet that reality, we begin to understand that at a very deep level, we understand that there's nothing in our experience that is capable of providing us with any kind of lasting happiness because it comes and goes. There's nothing that we can hold on to that will provide us with a lasting source of happiness. So this is the second characteristic of experience, the characteristic of dukkha, unsatisfactoriness, or suffering. The third characteristic is this characteristic of not-self, that it is that there is not anything in our experience that can be considered as I, me, or mine. And this one is usually the hardest one for people to understand. Because, partly because, it feels so much like I'm here. It just feels that way. That feeling itself becomes its own confirmation in a way. And the view or the belief that I'm here, in effect, becomes the way that we perceive all of our experience. And through that view, I talked about views last week in terms of the views of delusion. Through that view, we experience things that confirm that view and tend to not connect with or not take in evidence for the contrary, not take in the fact that, or facts that don't support. Or we may take them in, but just completely ignore the fact that this contradicts our belief. So somehow we hold these two things in our experience at once, that, yeah, we see these things happening, for instance, that we, you know, we recognize, I mean, we all know through the experience of meditation that when we meditate, there's this process that happens whereby we sit down, we try to pay attention to whatever we're paying attention to, the breath or whatever, and in that process, at some point, the mind wanders off. And we don't seem to have much control over that, that wandering thing. I mean, we kind of intended to stay here. So, was it the self that was intending to stay here, or the self that intended to wander? And did the self intend to wander? Who did that, anyway? And likewise, even more actually to the point on this, is the moment when we suddenly somehow come back into mindfulness, out of being lost. How did that happen? Who did that? Was that I that decided, oh, I'm going to wake up now? That's not usually our experience, that we're deciding that we're going to wake up in the meditation. We have the experience of coming back into awareness kind of spontaneously. So there's evidence around for not self, but we don't usually or typically think of it as evidence for not self. We think, oh, my mind wandered. Oh, I'm back. So it's a very hard teaching to take in, usually because we're listening to it from the perspective of self. And the perspective of self can't really grok this teaching. So there's a conundrum around it. There's a little bit of a leap of faith that we have to take initially around exploring this teaching. Although, you know, when I think of it, it's not so much of a leap of faith as it is a willingness to engage in just being here moment to moment with the open mind about what we might see as we engage in experience moment to moment. So with an open mind around our experience, if we keep an open mind about what we might see and what it might imply, we can begin to see this evidence for the fact that what we think of as self doesn't have the qualities that we normally impute to it. Well, what do you think of as self? When you think of self, what is it that you think of as self? We have one from before, the ego, the one that thinks it's in control.
Well, it has a quality of solidity.
A solidity, okay, so a sense of being fixed, here, of permanence almost.
It's fixed.
Okay.
And that includes even the thoughts that when you say or somebody says, oh, those thoughts are not me, I say, oh, yes, they are me. they are. They're part of that solidity.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And, you know, they're referred to as sort of as juicy, and they have a their own presence,
okay,
about
uh-huh.
them.
Uh-huh. So there's a sense of solidity, of essentially a sense of permanence around that notion of self. Did you have something? Yeah.
Uh-huh. I was thinking maybe sometimes will.
Will,
or
intention,
soul.
Yes. So the one who chooses, the one who decides, is what we think of as self. Mm-hmm.
I think of separateness.
Self
and
others.
Yourself and myself.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Identification of body as being self because of the solidity and the supposed identity of a name, even though deeply I know this isn't true,
uh-huh.
but it just seems to hang there sometimes.
The sense that the body is self?
Yeah,
or
identification of the body, of being a somebody with a name
okay.
and self.
Okay, uh-huh. Yeah. So the kind of, the fact that this body has kind of been here for a while, in a sense, kind of proves itself to be somebody.
Whatever it is that carries the continuity of our life.
Whatever, that's a good one. Yeah, the sense of continuity. So in a sense, like the notion of memory, in a way, you know, that we can remember that pulling of information across.
Mm-hmm. And also pulling it into the future.
And projecting into
projecting
the future.
Projecting it into
mm-hmm.
the future.
Mm-hmm. Anything else?
I kind of, it's an evolved thing. I think of self, false self, as a, it's almost like a computer virus. It's a parasite. The will, you might call it, is more of a tool. It kind of pushes the awareness aside. Awareness has to be in the moment. False self is always in the past or the future.
Well, a false self can be in the present, too.
But always filtering
it's through
experiences.
Yeah, it's through
moment.
Some view.
Never fully
yeah.
aware and awake at the time.
Yes, and yes.
I think of it as an ongoing parasite. It's a comfortable place to be.
A comfortable place to be, okay. Yeah, Victor, did you have another one?
My view is tangential to Bud's in that with ordinary things that are not self, things that are exist, we have the opportunity to see entropy. But with things of ourselves that we think about, that we constantly think about, we don't. There isn't entropy in the thought of my family or the things I love, or the things, the emotions that I bring on to things, because I always, I'm feeding it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that there's always a building up of that notion, that thing, that no sense of self. And so I don't see as we have the opportunity to really have entropy, the lack of energy causing that formation to actually work on it to fall away. We're constantly building up. We're constantly reminding ourselves what we like, what we dislike, etc.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's a lot out there in the room now. I don't think I can touch on all of it. I'm glad it's being recorded because I can go back and listen and think through things. But one of the things that the Buddha suggested about looking at self, looking at the experience, is to explore what we do think of as self. So when you have this sense of solidity, for example, bringing the attention to that experience of solidity. What is that experience of solidity? Of that sense that that thought has juiciness? And is that something that is always there? Is it always present, that feeling of solidity? Is it the same feeling of solidity every time you look at it? Or does it shift and change? So beginning to explore what we think of as self through our awareness, through our mindfulness. And again, being willing to suspend belief in our view. You know, recognize, okay, this is the view I am holding. And recognizing a view, recognizing that we're holding a particular view, self as controller, self as the continuity, self as solidity, self as, what were some of the others? I can't remember. So whatever it is that we hold as self, recognize, okay, that's the view I'm holding. So that rather than having to be seeing things from that perspective, when we take an experience, we can know that view is there and potentially be able to take in information that begins to erode the belief in that view. So that's kind of a basic instruction around whatever it is that you think of as self. So the one who chooses, for instance, look at that process by which choosing happens. And see whether it is actually an I that is choosing, or is it an I that comes after the choice that says, you know, a process of selfing that comes after the choice that says, I did that. That's actually mostly how this process of self works. It kind of takes on what things have happened and says, oh, that was me. Oh, that was me. That was me too. You know, it's like things start processing. It says post-validation. Yeah, it comes late. You know, it's actually, experience arises, choice arises, and then self arises, thinking I did that, or the idea. I shouldn't say self arises. I should say I making or mind making arises. Gill sometimes calls this selfing. I like this term, selfing. It's a process that happens in our minds, this notion of I or mine. So can we begin to explore how this process of I-making, mind-making happens? Now, it takes a quietness of mind to explore this. But on the other hand, there's a lot of things that come into our experience that without kind of exposing the view of what we think of as self, we'll just simply confirm the view. But if we expose that view and then start to look at just even our normal everyday, day-to-day experience, we'll start to see that there are things out there and experiences and ways of being in the world that, in just even in our normal daily life, begin to erode that concept and that belief. So the basic understanding, I'll read you something from the Buddha. Oh, do I have it? Let's see. Oh, I have it in here. This kind of summarizes. Where did it go? Well, I don't see it here. I may not have it with me. I'll try to summarize it. The Buddha is talking to someone who wants to understand what right view is. And the Buddha says something along the lines of, by and large, people take existence or experience either to, or see experience, see the world in terms either of existence or non-existence. That either something exists or it doesn't exist. And he said, I teach the Dharma of the middle, where existence and non-existence are kind of not relevant. And that's not his terms. Those are my interpretation of the text. That I teach, basically, with ignorance as a condition, mental formations arise. With mental formations as a condition, name consciousness arises. With consciousness as a condition, name and form arises. With name and form as a condition, the six sense spaces arise. With the six sense spaces as condition, contact will arise. With contact as a condition, feeling arises. With feeling as a condition, craving arises. With craving as a condition, clinging arises. With clinging as a condition, becoming arises. with becoming as a condition, suffering arises. And hence is the entire mass of suffering born. So he basically teaches that what we normally think of as self is a process. It's a flow of experience. And when we look into our experience moment to moment, we do see that it is a flow. We see that there is just this thing following this thing. And when we get pretty quiet, when the mind gets pretty settled and quiet, we actually see that the moment-to-moment unfolding is just cause and effect kind of unfolding. You know, in a simple way, you can see this in your experience. You know, even in your daily life, if you're sitting at your desk for a long time working at your computer, you know, there you are, you're sitting at your desk, and at some point, you know, because you've been sitting there for a while, you feel a pressure in your bladder. That pressure in your bladder conditions the desire to relieve that pressure. And the desire to relieve that pressure conditions the desire to move, which conditions then the movement, which then we get up and we go to the bathroom. So we normally think about this, you know, with our normal way of experiencing things. We're sitting there at our desk and we think, oh, I have to go to the bathroom. I need to do this. And there's a sense of me choosing to do this. If you actually look at what's happening, there's the experience of pressure conditioning a feeling of discomfort, conditioning the desire to relieve that discomfort, conditioning the intention to move, conditioning the movement. And there's actually nobody there doing anything. It's simply a process. And at some point in that process unfolding, we construct this notion of me going to do this. So there's that aspect of the process nature of our experience as basically being what is happening. So I think what some of the confusion around not self is that we have such an entrenched view of self that we think that if we understand not self, or if we move in that direction of releasing ourselves from this belief of not self, that somehow that will disappear, or there's a sense of losing something, a sense of loss, a sense of fear of losing something. And there's nothing there to lose. He said, that's pretty frightening. So this is one of the interesting aspects of the not-self teaching, actually. You know, somebody said also, what a relief. That when we think about this idea of not self, you know, that the thought of it from the perspective of self is frightening. From the view of self, or ego, yes. From the view of self or ego, the prospect of not self is frightening, because this ego kind of believes itself in a way. This self believes itself. And so it thinks, I'm going to disappear. And that feels frightening. Yeah, questions?
I think it could be a state of bliss also. You know, I can see where...
Could you talk into the microphone?
Yeah, I can see why I think people would think it'd be frightening, but I think it could also be a state of bliss to
yes.
not be a not self.
Exactly. To not be a not self, or to not be...
I think it could come together as one, just like total focus of just being without all those busy thoughts and interruptions would be a state of bliss.
It is.
Yeah, it
and
is.
And that is what the funny aspect of this teaching is. That's where I was kind of heading with this, that it's kind of a funny thing that from the perspective of self, it feels like a fearful thing. And that's the way a lot of people approach this teaching. They're frightened of this teaching. But so the teaching, the concept of the teaching can be frightening. But when we actually experience the truth of things are just in a flow, that there's no one there controlling or doing or figuring out or fixing or changing, that there's no solid thing here, it is such a relief. It's just like, oh my goodness, what kind of a burden have I just put down? You know, it just feels like, whew, like this huge relief. Gil keeps saying, letting go is relaxing.
I was following, I thought, what you were saying until the sense that the self, that there's nothing to lose. Because what I thought up until then you were saying was that this, the self and not self exist together. And they are both part of the process.
Well, the what we think of as self is simply a part of the process, yes. So the thing that we think of as self is simply an ongoing construction that's part of this process of feeling, conditions, craving, conditions, clinging, conditions, becoming. The becoming piece in that link is the process of selfing.
So when in one of the verses in the Tao Te Ching, in the Stephen Mitchell translation anyhow, says something about something to the effect that see the world as yourself. Hmm. Or as the self. I forget for sure which one it is.
Yeah, even the Buddha would is not that, say that. The Buddha would not say that. You know, the Buddha actually was trying to undercut any view of any kind of self, including a kind of a cosmic self.
Yeah. So did the Buddha's teachings arise, do you think, from the self or the not-self of the Buddha? Stop.
The teachings, I think, arose from the experience, from the contacting of the truth. And then it has to come back through conventional words, conventional language. And so, you know, partly this I think some of what's happening is that there is the conundrum of language going on here. Yeah, the experience versus the concepts. And that comes back to what one of the things you were saying around how it's hard to to cut through the self, because the things that we take to be self or me or mine, we continue to reify them. We continue to impute a reality concreteness to them. I think reification is, I just looked up this term in Wikipedia yesterday. It's the fallacy of concreteness or something like that is what reification means. Reification, R-E-I-F-I-C-A-T-I-O-N. To make usually means to do again. So R-E, and then it's like reification. I don't know what ification means, but...
In law, R-E-S is thing.
Ah, so maybe R-E-I means thing.
Yeah. From R-E-S, which is a Latin word for
thing.
Thingness.
Interesting. Yeah.
So you're turning something into something
through a process. I'm sorry?
The word was reification.
reification.
And it means trying to make the concrete.
Well, it's a process that just happens in our minds often, that we concretize things, we make things seem real and solid when they're not. So the process by which this happens, or the part of the mind that does this reification, is the perception. It's the perceiving. I don't know. Ask Rickanson that question. I don't know where in the brain. So that perceptual process, the process of recognition, the process of seeing something, chair, there is something out there, you know, there's something out there, and it's got form and it's got color and it's in the visual domain, and if I went over in there and touched it, it would have texture and I would be able to feel things. And from that process, we see things over and over again. You know, I've seen these chairs many times now, so, you know, there's a kind of a familiarity with these chairs. And the process of perception is about recognizing, remembering, assigning, it's kind of a shortcut. In a way, it's a way our mind makes a shortcut around things so it doesn't have to figure things out every time. And it's extremely useful to have this process going in our minds. But what happens is that we confuse this process with reality, that we take the concept to be the reality, where the reality is when we actually come into contact with what's actually happening is seeing form, color. If I were to touch it right now, it's just form and color. That's all it is in my experience. It's just form and color. If I were to go to touch it, I would sense some hardness, some solidity, some roughness, some smoothness, some coolness, all kinds of textures. If I threw something at it, I would hear something. So there's input that comes in. And we because we live through perception, the shortcut being so useful, we begin to believe the concepts as being the reality. So because it's such a useful shortcut, we miss, in fact, and you know, I think we all have had the experience of this. It's like, it's hard to see a chair as form and color, you know? Yeah. Yeah, we see it as a chair. You know, you could, I mean, that if you were to draw it, you know, there's a way to draw it such that it looks three-dimensional. You know, if you were to draw it, you would begin to kind of contact the form, the shape, and the color that's coming in, you know. So like on the edge of that chair, it's pure white where the light is reflecting. And then it kind of moves to a duller gray. So, you know, there's just that color that is coming into our sense perception. And the concepts, and this is one thing that Utejaniya says that I find interesting. He says concepts are permanent, and I don't agree with that phrasing of it, but what it does imply is that with the continual movement into concept over and over again, thinking about that concept, it gets a kind of a sense of solidity in our experience.
That's what I was saying.
Yes, that's what you were saying. That's what I'm pointing to. So that it is the concept that becomes solid. And part of the way to work with that is to recognize this process of concept, the process of perception happening. So it is the solidity of the concept that is then mistaken for my family, my body, my bag, whatever.
It's the same thing with the chair.
Exactly.
It's still a concept. Because, you know, what if I turn it upside down and use it as a table or something?
Right.
So,
yeah. It's in the same area, yeah,
that's
yeah.
Concept, or the label. Is a concept like a label?
A concept is kind of like a label, yes. Yeah. Yeah, it's a naming, it's a recognition. And that the process of this perception, this concept, happens, you can see it happening in your experience. And I think one of the easiest places to experience this in your meditation is in hearing, using the hearing. So play with hearing sometime in your meditation, you know, especially here. There's so many great sounds that come through, you know. So you're sitting here quietly and a motorcycle zooms by. What happens in your experience when that motorcycle zooms by? You've got the experience of hearing. You don't hear motorcycle. You hear vibration, you hear pitch and tone. And then the mind, having heard many motorcycles in the past, creates the concept motorcycle. And you may experience this either, a couple of ways I've experienced this, as a word that you say to yourself in your mind, motorcycle, or perhaps as an image of a motorcycle that you see, or you might even occasionally, rarely, I have seen the word written out as a visual image. Some people perceive that way. So the process of perception can be explored in our experience. And this is a huge place where we mistake self. Because of this perceptual process, things become more solid. And that's where that feeling of solidity comes in, is that there's an imputing of permanence, an imputing through this continual reflection on our experience. So I've gotten through like the first three lines of my notes. We've still got 15 minutes. Yeah, bud.
Is there an agency that detects the difference between skillful and unskillful?
Is there an agency that detects the difference between skillful and unskillful? I don't know that I would use the term agency. What do you mean by agency?
The self that detects the difference between skillful and unskillful.
Well, there is no self that detects the difference between skillful and unskillful.
So who is detecting the difference between skillful and unskillful? How is that done?
How is that done? I think, you know, this is try to think of how the Buddha might respond to this.
How does wisdom?
Wisdom, this is the piece. This is the piece, wisdom. That basically, you know, when wisdom arises, it knows the difference between skillful and unskillful. When delusion is present, it generally doesn't know the difference between skillful and unskillful. How wisdom arises is through being in the present moment without filters, without delusion. The absence of delusion is the presence of wisdom. So it is wisdom that understands the difference between skillful and unskillful. And, you know, if a skillful choice happens, it is wisdom choosing. If an unskillful choice happens, it is delusion choosing. It's not me choosing.
But wisdom is a conditioned state.
Yes, wisdom is a conditioned state. And it's just like, you know, the process nature, the flow of of things coming to be. Intention is a conditioned state. Choice is a conditioned state. It arises, choice arises out of previous conditions, kind of in that description of the bladder pressure. You know, that the intention arises out of some conditions. And when wisdom is present, skillful choice tends to arise. When delusion is present, or you could say when delusion is present, unskillful choice tends to arise. When delusion is absent, skillful choice tends to arise.
The concept of not self for me is most useful in breaking down conditioning.
So there's a distinction here between the kind of conditioning, from what I'm hearing you say, so you're talking about a kind of conditioning that we think of as having put us together as me with my habits and patterns.
Habits, right.
Yeah,
habits,
so the conditioning of habits and patterns. And it is definitely helpful to, like, use the reflection, for instance, not me, not mine, not who I am, around habits and patterns to help break down the kind of entrenched nature of those patterns. You know, the conditioning, you know, in the way the mind works, as the Buddha says, that which we frequently ponder becomes the inclination of our minds. The more we think a particular thing, the more the mind tends to go there. And so we have to do some work to undo those kind of grooves that get worn in the mind, to kind of consciously choose, okay, or see that pull to that pattern and see, okay, can I not go there? So using the means of not me, not mine, not who I am. So that's one aspect of the conditioning. So that's a kind of a term that we often talk about. Our conditioning has led to these habits, these patterns. And the process of dependent origination of what I described before, feeling leads to craving, leads to clinging, leads to becoming, is a process of cause and effect. So everything that happens, so that feeling that arises in dependence on the body, and it arises in dependence on the state that the mind is in at the time that contact hits the body. So that feeling arises in dependence on other things. It is conditioned. So that's not conditioning we're going to break. You know, we're not going to break the fact that that body and mind condition feeling. That process, you know, just like that is the way mind and body flux happens. So we're not going to really break that. What we do is to see it. We recognize that process happening, and it begins to free us from the belief that I'm there doing it. Which, as you say, this is back to one of the other questions of why is this useful? Why is this helpful to recognize this? Recognizing the truth of not self. First of all, it's helpful because it is in line with the truth. And so as we stop fighting what is actually happening and come into alignment with what is actually happening, this relief kind of comes in. So this kind of feeling of, okay, this is the way it is. And when we come into alignment with truth, there tends to be a letting go of suffering, that we don't suffer. So this whole process by which we create self is the process by which suffering is created. And so the recognition of how that process not only creates self but creates suffering is one of the benefits, because then we recognize that in that process is where the suffering is. And if I don't engage or don't attach, let's say don't attach to that process, the suffering begins to fall away for us. So this insight, this recognition, and you know, these three characteristics of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not self. One of the, and this I think is going to have to be close to one of the last things I say. one of the, as I said at the beginning, they're thought of as characteristics often. That's how they are talked about in the Buddhist commentaries, that they are characteristics of experience. But that is kind of thing-like, you know. Characteristic is kind of a thing-like assignment. When the Buddha speaks about these qualities, he doesn't actually use the term characteristic. He talks about that they are perceptions. We perceive impermanence. We perceive unsatisfactoriness. And we perceive not self. So that they're ways of looking at experience rather than being necessarily a thing assigned to experience. And they are insights. That when our attention meets things as they are, meets experience as it is, it recognizes the truth of these. It's not something that we have to do, particularly. The thing that we have to kind of open ourselves to is the possibility of these truths so that we can take in the truths. With the view, again, the views of permanence, the view of things being satisfying, the view of self, from those perspectives, it's hard to take in the information that things aren't that way. So, but just the willingness, if we can just be willing to meet our experience as it is, it will slowly begin to reveal to us these three ways of seeing our experience as insights. So they're not something particularly to do. We can cultivate the perception of not self through reflecting not me, not mine, not who I am, through using that reflection. So any other comments, thoughts? I've got way more to say. I will talk more next week, yeah, but...
I don't know if there's time to address this. At what age do you think a child should be to begin to understand?
Oh, that's an interesting question. You know, I don't know. I kind of think... That's a hard one, you know.
The reason I ask the question is that there are stages in early life where the ego is important.
Yes.
Keeps you from harm, sets you on a path, and so on. So at some point, you've got to make the transition.
Yeah. As one famous psychologist is, I believe, misquoted, because he said, I never said this, but... Jack Engler is famously attributed the fact that you have to have a healthy sense of self in order to let go of the self. So, you know, I don't know. You know, it's interesting to me to think about this, because, you know, the notion that we used to have around language, for instance, was that it's too hard for, you know, we shouldn't try to teach children language. It's too complex for them. So let's wait until they get older. And, you know, we learned that it's like 1 year old. This is the time to, like, you know, if you got eight languages, they can figure them out, you know. So, you know, the brain is very malleable. And I don't know the answer to that question. You know, my gut sense says I wouldn't, if I had a child, start teaching them this probably until they hit their teens. You know, that's kind of my intuition, but I don't know. My sense is, you know, that one of the interesting pieces that I find about the way the Tibetans do things, you know, they identify someone as being a reincarnation of someone at a very young age, like two or something, and they take them from their family. I mean, it's, you know, it seems hard to think about that. And then they put them into this environment where they are surrounded by the teachings. And, you know, it creates some beautiful beings. The Dalai Lama, you know, it creates some beautiful beings, the way that they're doing something. I think that they're, you know, they're primarily probably surrounding them with love and compassion.
But you think it's a grand spurt. They don't think it's
anybody. Oh, well, you assume somehow they're picking, you know, they know some, they're picking them. I don't... So, with your permission, we'll continue this conversation next week. We just want to make sure. This is great. You know, I like this kind of, the dynamic kind of nature to this. So, thank you.